Welcome to Unbridled Aloud, a series of conversations with writers sponsored by Unbridled Books. I'm Kay Callison. Today we're talking with Mark Estrin about his newest novel, The Lamentations of Julius Morantz. It's maybe best summed up as a religious dystopia set in the present. It's also really funny, kind of a cross between George Carlin and Mel Brooks, and you can find readings from Lamentations on the Unbridled website. The Lamentations of Julius Morantz is Estrin's fourth novel with Unbridled. The first three, in order, were Insect Dreams, The Education of Arnold Hitler, and Golem Song. That being said, it's really hard to know where to start with an introduction to such a Renaissance man as Mark Estrin. If you're already a fan, you might have caught our earlier conversation with this guy on episode 6 of Unbridled Aloud, where you would have learned that he only took up writing in earnest about 12 years ago now. But if you're new to Mark Estrin's work, here's some good stuff to know before we talk about The Lamentations of Julius Morantz. Bio. Born in 1939. Grew up in the Bronx in an all-Jewish part of the city. He never went to Coney Island until he started researching Julius. Science. He left a highly prestigious Rockefeller Institute fellowship before finishing the PhD to take a master's degree in theater direction from UCLA. He became a master of guerrilla and puppet theater, which permeate the street and subway scenes of Lamentations. Religious studies and philosophy. In 1985, Estrin left his job as director of Burlington, Vermont's Peace and Justice Center to take a Master's of Divinity from UC Berkeley and serve two congregations as a Unitarian minister. He was fired from both for being too political. The grand organizing principles of Mark Estrin's professional lives, including his fiction, political activism, especially peace work, and music. He's on the steering committee of the Vermont Green Party and active in Vermonters for a Just Peace in Palestine, Israel. He took up the cello in college and is an accomplished musician. He performs and sings regularly with the Vermont Philharmonic Orchestra and other musical groups, including one dedicated to sacred harp or shape note singing, with which he has great fun in Lamentations. He makes his home with his wife Donna in Burlington, Vermont, and is the father of two children from his first marriage. Finally, a few grace notes. Fred Ramey is Mark Estrin's editor at Unbridled Books, with whom he works very closely. Lydia, the great love of Julius's life, who he seeks out for help and comfort on day present of the novel, is in advanced stages of ovarian cancer. And day present of the novel is June 19, 2003, 50th anniversary of the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. We also need to say up top that Gecko, the secret coalition that's running the world in Lamentations, is composed of the Sierra Club, the World Council of Churches, the Pentagon, and the CIA. Mark Estrin, what is the story that's being told in The Lamentations of Julius Morantz?
Julius is an interesting kid who grows up in Coney Island and decides, because of his experiences on the rides and the way his father treats them as interesting problems in physics, decides to become a physicist. Julius discovers an anti-gravity device because of money and support that was given to the physics department in Middlebury College for anti-gravity research. And that device is jumped on and sequestered by a secret organization, each of whose components wants to use an anti-gravity device for its own end. So Julius eventually gives them permission to do that, and that, of course, is his defining moment of maximum fall, although I've been playing with the idea of falling throughout the whole novel. It turns out that we are now faced with this incredible phony rapture and the religious dystopia that goes with it, and Julius has had too much of it and sees the consequences of what he did in giving permission to use his anti-gravity device that he decides to Spill the Bean.
And this group is called,
group is called Gecko.
Gecko.
The
right.
Geheimnis Coalition, the secret coalition.
Can you give the listener a sense of the world we're living in the novel, in the sense that shows up in the text, like words like jammies are trademarked, and this is the ultimate privatization and corporatization of all world affairs, right?
Right, and the Central Intelligence, we now have the Central Intelligence Corporation.
Right.
And they have ads and jingles, and a lot of it has to do with the religious levels. I mean, there are now kids are playing with their plush crucifixes and all of that, and there's just a total, total immersion of the culture in religious language and imagery.
And what we call branding, like even
right.
the stripes on the flag, right, have
right.
each been branded by somebody?
Right. The white spaces in the American flag are given over to corporations based on their position in the corporate profit list. There are different versions of the American flag. I think the current one is 52.3. So that's all laid out as a kind of comic religious dystopia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once Julius decides to spill the beans, he becomes a threat to the powers that be. And they then track him down and use his own machine to eliminate him.
Hoist by his own petard, so to speak.
Exactly. Yeah, it's quite a petard.
Tell us about Lamentations as a source, as a concept in this novel.
Well, Lamentations, of course, are a section of the Bible. They are the prophetic bewailings of a culture. The guy who wrote the Lamentations, or the people who wrote the Lamentations, were bewailing the desolation of Jerusalem, which had been conquered by the Babylonians. And they saw their city, which was once a princess, now become a slave. And that, of course, metaphorically, is a lot to do with the desolation that people have now looking around at either American culture or whatever, that we're so corrupted and broken down in what the original visions were. Actually, I had originally called it the Lamentations of Jeremiah, and then I had to give him a last name, and then I thought, typically stupid little things that I do, I thought, well, maybe I'll call him Julius instead. Then I thought, well, he's sort of like Orange Julius, isn't he? He's a kind of little devil. and Marantz is orange in Yiddish. So Marantz means Orange Julius in Yiddish. And then there was this overlap by the time I came to the end with the Flaubert stories about St. Julian and all of that. The other thing is, a very favorite piece of mine is Thomas Tallis' Lamentations of Jeremiah, which I have conducted and done as a puppet show and sung in. So the format of the Lamentations is often given with the Hebrew letters. So I have this one level of the book, which are the Hebrew letters. There are actually three things going on. One is the story of Julius, the front story and the back story, the front story of his flight from the government and the back story of his growing up in Coney Island. And then another level, and there are, the three levels are in three different voices. That's in the kind of omniscient narrative voice. And then there's the Lamentations themselves, which are in Julius's voice. And then there is the alphabet, Gimel Dalet chapters, which are in my voice, which are sort of philosophical meditations on this and that.
Philip, Julius Marantz's father, names him for Julius Caesar. Your joke is the Julius Marantz. Now, what about Julius Rosenberg? Because that's extremely important in terms
right,
of the
right.
date.
Well, yeah, there's all sorts of Juliuses floating through of different angles. So, yes, Julius Caesar and Julius Rosenberg and Julius Marantz and Julian.
All will be well.
All will be well, Julian, and then there's the Julian who is the saint in Flaubert, sleeping with death at the end, which I've made drawings of.
Right. Did that just find its way in as you wrote the story?
Yeah. Okay, this stuff all starts out with stupid little ideas, and then echoes ring and bells ring, and So, yeah, here we've been talking about five different Juliuses, and I hadn't even known that that was his name.
Really?
Sure.
Well, I'm also assuming that the rise of the Christian right, and especially the reemergence of the rapture movement, had some inspiration.
Yeah,
there.
And I think that's when I started thinking about it. I had a review, maybe it was for Insect Dreams or something, and it was in the same journal, which had as a feature article an interview with the guys who wrote Left Behind.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, here I am in the same magazine with them.
Truth is stranger than fiction?
Well, it is a serious issue, the rise of not the Christian right per se, but the Christian right that is aiming for and hopeful for Armageddon and mm-hmm. apocalypse.
And speaking of all the different Juliuses in the novel, there are a number of uses of living forms and words that double. There is Gecko, the political coalition, but then there's Julius's Gecko as a little boy, you know, which gets him so interested in anti-gravity as a little kid.
Well, you know, that was another one of those funny little discoveries. The first thought was that when Julius invented the anti-gravity machine, it was jumped on and sequestered by some kind of secret organization. Like a lot of those Hitlerian German organizations, it had a name shortening, like the Gestapo, right? And this, for Geheimniskoalition, would be Gecko. And then I thought, well, hey, Gecko, wait a minute. That fits. Gecko or Gecko. And then, you know, it's about gravity, you know, and defying gravity and all that kind of stuff. So I gave Julius a pet gecko, and then that started his scientific experimentation. But I didn't have any of this planned, you know. It just sort of falls into place out of the sky, like Julius.
This is also a dystopian novel, and you chose to set it in the present. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, Fred said, hey, why don't, this should be in the near future. And I thought, no, it shouldn't be in the near future. This should be, this is happening. I want the reader to understand that this isn't a projection. As exaggerated as it is, it's happening right now. So I said it in the near past.
Another one of the doubling things and tripling things is the apple. You know, we have the fall of man and the apple in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. And then we have Newton's apple with the law of gravity that sets all of this off. Is there an apple for Julius, do you think?
Well, I mean, Julius is in the Adam position with respect to the apple. Julius was tempted by science.
Mm-hmm.
And comes in the course of the book to a deeper understanding of good and evil.
Julius is consumed with guilt. Do you think he's justified in his guilt? Because what has he done but, in fact, use his God-given reason to pursue science? And is he responsible for what is done with the science that he, in fact, pursued and the machine he built?
Depends upon how you want to look at guilt. For instance, on the fall, I talk about Heidegger. And Heidegger asserts, and I think that's in the chapter, that one is guilty from the very fact of existence, because in Heideggerian thought, Dasein, our existence, is always capable of conscience and understanding what is undone and all of that. And there's always things undone and the potential that's not realized, and so one has a vague sense of guilt from a Kierkegaardian sense. There's guilt before the enormity of God, and so there's that kind of guilt. It isn't like I stole something from a store guilt. There's the guilt of existence, and there's the guilt of human existence, because humans are capable of, and human existence, according to Heidegger, and I believe this is true, certainly explains Jewish guilt, that human existence is coeval with sense of guilt.
Uh-huh.
So at that level, Julius is guilty. Julius is also clearly guilty in the gecko scene. That is, he signs the piece of paper, which gives them permission to go ahead and use the doodad.
But they were going to use it anyway.
They were. I mean, they may or may not have been, but in any case, he signed on.
Because they threatened to kill him if he didn't. And they left that part out in the transcript.
Yeah, they did.
Of the proceedings.
But the act of signing that piece of paper, regardless of whether it wouldn't happen, have happened anyway, is extremely significant. And so, you know, I think he is guilty. And there's another level of his not foreseeing the possible consequences of the work. It's like the atomic scientist who said, it's up to them whether they drop the bomb and where. We're just doing the work we're discovering about nature. But scientists, I think, have to take some responsibility.
What about Coney Island as the prime fact of Julius's childhood? This novel is a lamentation, yes, but it's also a celebration of the mystique, the fact of Coney Island and as a cultural artifact and icon.
Coney Island as an idea of America is something I've thought about. There is so much of that, and it's more and more and more obvious of this kind of phony amusement culture that panders in all kinds of miscellaneous themes. And so I did some, in fact, quite a bit of research on Coney Island and came up with that historical chapter on Coney Island, all of which is true. It's very bizarre, but it's true, and it deepens the general understanding of Coney Island as that kind of a metaphor for America.
Well, and also, it's again, it fits in with this issue of good and evil and the purpose for which things are engendered and then how they get used. Julius's father uses Coney Island to teach his son physics.
Yeah, well, it's kind of an obvious thing to do if you're that kind of a guy, you know, an inventor and somebody who's inveterately curious. And he's a great teacher.
How much of a Jeremiad do you see this novel as being?
It isn't really, you know. For me, it was a meditation. I'm sure that reviews will seize on that. And in fact, the first review did seize on that and featured that almost exclusively. The headline was Mark Estrin Takes on the Christian Right or something like that. But to me, the book is about a lot of things, that being one of them for sure. But it's basically about the fall. It's about aspiring to rise and falling.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about Roger Babson?
Rod Babson is why this whole book started, and that was back in the 90s. I was living in Middlebury, Vermont, and there is a stone. Well, I've described it in the book. There is a stone that was put up by the Gravity Foundation that Babson started and congratulated the workers against gravity and all of that. And I thought, oh, my God, what a ripoff, you know. The physics department must have taken money from some kind of nut for anti-gravity research and taken the money and run. So I just said, I wonder how this happened. And this was without consulting anybody in the physics department. And I just made up this story about somebody who was a physicist at Middlebury who would invent an anti-gravity device and what would happen. Subsequently, it was way more interesting than that because I got in touch with the reference librarian at Babson College, one of Babson's project was a couple of colleges, actually, business schools. And he led me into this whole world of Babson projects, one of which was this gravity research project. And I went to visit a physicist at Harvard and who knew about this. And it was just amazing what the results were in terms of gravity theory from Babson's very idiosyncratic interest in the subject.
The comic novel versus the serious novel. I take it that you think that this novel started more as a comic novel with serious undertones and ended up being a serious novel with comic undertones. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, it was largely Fred pushing me on that. Fred Raving, my editor. His complaint was originally, why is Julius such a cartoon character? And I don't know, I thought, what's wrong with a cartoon character, you know?
How was he a cartoon character, other than being based on Orange Julius?
I'm not really sure. Fred saw it as a novel of loss, and I didn't really understand that, and I started looking for that, and then, you know, surely it was there. But there's an amazing Steinberg cartoon, you know, the cartoonist, William Steinberg, and it's a drawing of a guy, a fairly realistic guy drawn in crayon, in his hotel room, and he is dancing with a stick figure. And I always love this cartoon. I love the idea that of the clash of styles, that you could have something basically realistic dancing with something that was entirely unrealistic. But that clash of cartoon set inside realism is, I think, why I felt originally that Cartoon Julius was okay. Well, he's gotten to be less of a cartoon. And I like it. I like what happened.
And then there's Lydia, the great love of his youth, who is, she's a Catholic worker. Her pursuit of faith, his of reason, has made them very incompatible.
Well, Lydia is important because she represents genuine religious feeling as opposed to this phony religiosity of the rapture. And Julius had a relationship with her, would-be relationship with her, that was poisoned by several things, including her inability to accept a secular relationship with a man. But Julius also, yes, coming at it from reason, and she comes at it from feeling. And also remember that Julius is, or was, raised Jewish, and the idea of a Jew being fundamentally incompatible with the Catholic vision is something that I'm playing with. I can't write a definitive statement about it, but their backgrounds are sufficiently different. They come together over a shared trauma. Their parents are both killed on the same airplane crash, and then they try to make a go of it, but they can't do it. And Julius spends this trip, once he sees Lydia again, remembering what she brought him on a religious level.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, by the time he gets to her, she can't receive him because she is going to be dead, and she's dying very quickly. He doesn't know it, and she doesn't say it. But her resistance to joining him in his project of revealing what the rapture is all about just can't happen.
Right. And as a youth, he was himself raptured by the force of music, Christian music specifically. And
Messiaen's piece called The Ascension.
Mm-hmm. And he tried to become a Catholic. He's always pursued the question of faith and of religion in the larger sense of the word.
He was trying to rise, you know. He'd always been attracted to rising because he always had a very severe notion of falling.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think the idea, I mean, nobody rises in Judaism. The Messiah comes down, but no, you know, there's no ascension in Judaism.
Also, Lydia and music and the Lydian mode. Can you tell us about that and how you're playing with that?
Yeah. There is a very, very, perhaps the height, for me anyway, of Beethoven, the late string quartet, and the height of that string quartet is a movement in which he writes in the Lydian mode. A Lydian mode, and the connection for me is not so much with the old church Lydian modes, but rather with Beethoven's use of it in this extraordinary movement in the 15th string quartet, which he titles something like the Song of Thanks of an invalid who has been sick, who is now healed, to the Godhead. And the content of the work, musically, is the putting together of this extraordinarily disparate presentation into an incredibly woven, consistent whole. So it's the achieving of wholeness in this movement. I think, yes, that she has lived a life of wholeness, and yes, wholeness is what he desires, not the dystopian kind of this and that of the world.
How would you describe the relationship between faith and reason in the drama of this novel?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. In a certain way, Gecko is very reasonable. Each of the organizations organizations in Gekko see the possibility, reason the possibility of Julius's invention, the doodad, which, by the way, if people haven't read Insect Dreams, some people say the doodad is a silly name, but the Manhattan Project called the bombs a gadget, and they didn't talk about bombs, and Julius doesn't talk about an anti-gravity device. Similarly to the Manhattan Project, and that's part of the parallel, is that it's called the doodad. Each of these organizations sees the possibility in the doodad of the rational possibility of advancing its goals and of doing something good for the Earth and for the current situation. And so this opening chapter of called Gekko, where people have at Julius and try to get him to sign the rights to use the doodad for the purposes, is a very rational program presented by each of the speakers. The Pentagon wants to use the doodad to get rid of certain enemies and make for less war, because nobody will be fighting against the United States. The World Council of Churches wants to use the doodad to turn people back to the church and turn people back to God and make them rethink their secular values, and that too is presented as a progressive thing to do. And the Sierra Club wants to use the doodad to shoot people up into the ozone hole and block the ozone rays, you know, reduce the population problem, and that too is reasonable and rational, and it's the kind of reason and ration that's called crackpot reason. And crackpot reason is one of the great dangers of rationality in science. You know, that's been a continual theme of mine. And faith is Lydia, I suppose, although, you know, these people have faith in a certain way, and they present their arguments in a religious language, that doing these things, plugging the ozone hole or reducing the population or turning people back to the churches or reducing war by getting rid of you, and they do have faith that these will solve the problems that everybody in the room, including Julius, including me, including the reader, presumably, recognize as existing in the world today. And that's where the crackpot part comes in. So there is an interplay of faith and reason, although not, I wasn't specifically addressing it. It's just out there anywhere you look in the world.
Julius says specifically, faith is a talent, a gift I don't have. I can only keep searching. And Lydia replies, you wouldn't seek him if you hadn't already found him.
It's true that Julius is unhappy with his life in and the consequences in the secular world. And to that extent, similarly to kind of Heideggerian guilt, he realizes that there could be or must be something more, but he can't get to it. So I think what she says is probably true. Somebody who is truly without any kind of religious sensibility would never have been tempted in the first place. You just say, I mean, it's a bunch of bullshit, forget about it. One seeks because of some kind of inchoate vision of something to be sought for.
For Julius, the question posed by Camus about suicide being the only serious philosophical problem becomes extremely real.
Right, because at a certain point he has to accept the consequences of his life and admit that it's the end of his life. It's a conscious laying himself out for the death that will come upon him. And that, of course, is an interesting Camusian position of that everybody is facing execution, even if it's just that we're all going to die of whatever we die of, but that there's an execution ahead for everybody. And towards the end of the book, Julius realizes that his execution is at hand, and he wants to go in a certain way. And the last chapter is his completing his cycle on Earth.
He returns home to Coney Island.
He returns home for his transfiguration, yeah.
Another thing in the book that is sort of like all the different Juliuses, the apples, the geckos, is the very word gravity.
Gravitas, its weight, its inertia. It's what something like the Kierkegaard quote, that I had about why you can't rise. Yeah, so yes, it's playful. It's much more than scientific Newtonian gravity. And anti-gravity, by the way, is what it takes to be a humorist, to be comical, to be a cartoonist, etc. You have to be anti-gravity.
Really?
Well, you know, the stick figure has very little weight. And the idea that you could, in fact, dance with a stick figure is a pretty radical idea.
That's great. I like that. What are some of the things that you would hope that a reader would take away from this novel, The Lamentations of Julius Morantz?
Well, some sort of reflection on the current state of affairs, the current rhetoric and jargon that's being used to justify it, the way people are imprisoned inside of it, the possibility or impossibility of escape and transcendence, some feeling for Julius as a person, and the tensions that he is forced into, and some notion of the history of this in the country and of the metaphor of Coney Island. And there's a lot of stuff in the book, and people take away what they take away.
Well, Mark Estrin, thanks so much for taking time to talk with me today about The Lamentations of Julius Morantz on Unbridled Aloud.
Well, okay, thank you. It's always wonderful to have these great discussions. Thanks a lot.
This series of podcasts is sponsored by Unbridled Books, who promise you that rarest of pleasures, a good read. Other writers we're talking with these days include Margaret Cesare Thompson, Michael Pritchett, and Pamela Thompson. For more information about Mark Estrin and other titles from Unbridled Books, check out their website at unbridledbooks.com. You'll find all kinds of interesting stuff there, including book study guides for most of their titles, and a link to Mark Estrin and other Unbridled authors' websites. We also wanted to tell you that Rehearsing with Gods, Mark Estrin's memoir about his years with the Bread and Puppet Theater, won a Theater Book of the Year award in 2004. This program was produced by Kay Callison for Unbridled Books. For other interviews with authors of fine prose conducted by Kay Callison, also known as Kay Bonetti, go to the American Audio Prose Library website at americanaudioprose.org. The music is by Tom Andes from his solo piano CD, One Voice. You can find it on Amazon.com. For Unbridled Aloud, this is Kay Callison.